us through your word, and that you will change us and transform us and inspire us. But Lord, it will be your doing, and we thank you for that in Jesus' name. Amen.
Amen.
Very warm welcome to all of you. And a welcome if you're online. Great, I can't see you, you can see me. Great to see you, have you all with us. So I'm Kath, if you don't know, I'm married to Phil. I don't know, I went down this rabbit trail in the first service, so I'll do it again. Phil's been very supportive this week. I've had a fairly stressful week at work, and Phil will try and claim he's cooked 5 nights this week. One of those was actually Thai takeaways, so I'm not sure that quite counts, but he's very supportive. He's very supportive. He's threatening that it's quite hard work when I've got sermon prep as well as work. But anyway, it's great to be with you all and following on this book of Nehemiah that was started last week. Last week was chapter 1 and the very first bit of chapter 2, and today we're picking up the rest of chapter 2 and chapter 3. So just by way of starting, my first slide, there we go. I've just got a slide of modern day Jerusalem to remind us that this is where today's story is set. So modern day Jerusalem, this is the view from the Mount of Olives. You can see there's still a wall around the old city in the middle. The middle part's the old city. There's still a wall. The current wall's been there about 500 years. It was built during the Ottoman Empire. And in the foreground, there's actually got a deepish valley, the Valley of Kidron, which is mentioned in the story. So there's a valley in the foreground, and then you go up to the walls. In fact, at the time of Nehemiah, the wall wouldn't have gone as far to the right, and it went further down the hill to the left, which is where the old city and the city of David were. So the actual configuration of the wall was different, but Jerusalem has always been a city that's had either walls or ruins of walls. Phil and I had the chance to visit there just over a year ago, and it was amazing, I have to say. It is, you know, one of those cities that's been a holy city for centuries. And it was wonderful to visit. So if we pick up our story in Nehemiah, Nehemiah was the cupbearer to the king of Persia. Persia was the biggest empire in the world at the time, 2,500 years ago. And just so that you kind of get your bearings in terms of where Nehemiah started off from, the part of Persia he was in is where modern-day Iran is. So he was probably in the sort of, on our modern maps, southwestern Iran, where the story began last week. And God gave Nehemiah this dream to rebuild Jerusalem, which was in ruins. But if you think about it, and I just want us to pause and think about this, at the time, humanly speaking, for Nehemiah, this must have seemed quite an improbable or even impossible dream. If we think about it, Jerusalem had at that time been in ruins for 120 years. The walls were all in ruins, the gates had been burned down. The walls were quite extensive, they were thick and heavy, lots of rubble everywhere. And the project of rebuilding it had been unsuccessful for 120 years, and there had been a fairly recent attempt with Ezra that had failed, the king had blocked it. And so it seemed a bit impossible. If you think about Christchurch, we've got one sort of significant ruin left at the moment, the Christchurch Cathedral, since the earthquake 10 years. It's only been there 10 years. And in our modern, affluent city of 400,000, we're still sort of having trouble working out whether we can rebuild it or not, and is it too expensive and too hard to do or not, and there's all sorts of politics with that. But, you know, to put that in perspective, that's one building. This was the whole wall around the city. So it was a big project. And of course, we still have memory of the Christchurch Cathedral. Most of us, if we've been in Christchurch for the last 10 or 15 years, we remember what the cathedral was like. In fact, Nehemiah's time, there would be no one alive who remembered an intact Jerusalem. It would have been handed down in stories, I'm sure, from grandparents or parents, great-grandparents, what Jerusalem used to be like. But no one would have actually had any living memory of it as a functioning, intact city. And of course, Nehemiah himself had never even been there. If you think about it, he was born in Persia, and over in Iran, where we think of it. He was born there. He grew up there. He's in the royal court there. So he's very disconnected, actually, from life in Jerusalem. Now, he was brought up as a Jew, and so there would have been, you know, perhaps family connections, and there would be heritage connections.
but he didn't have those direct links. So I guess, you know, for him coming into Jerusalem, it's not like he would just know everybody and be able to take, you know, there's no automatic right for him to take charge. So there'd be some cultural disconnect too, coming out of a wealthy court, going into an area that was in exile and poverty. And of course, Nehemiah probably didn't even understand the scale of the problem at this stage, because he hadn't seen it. There'll be local politics and dynamics too at play, of course, and you wouldn't understand any of those. You don't have any of the backstory. So really, what I'm trying to say is, it's a pretty audacious dream to think that he single-handedly was going to travel about a four-month journey from Persia to Jerusalem. In those days, it was 4 months. And somehow get Jerusalem rebuilt, get the walls all rebuilt, getting the local people engaged. A very audacious dream. But Nehemiah firmly believes, after this period of some months of prayer and fasting that we heard about last week, at the end of that time of prayer, Nehemiah firmly believes that God has put in his heart this plan for Jerusalem to be rebuilt and for him to be involved in that. And so if we pick up our story in Nehemiah chapter 2, verse 11 and 12, Nehemiah says this. He says, I went to Jerusalem, so quite a long journey to get there, and after staying there 3 days, presumed for a bit of a rest, I set out during the night with a few men. I had not told anyone what my God had put on my heart to do for Jerusalem. There were no mounts with me except the one I was riding on. And so, of course, it's a bit of a solo journey at this stage. One man with a dream, a vision for what he could do. And he firmly believes God has put it in his heart. But he's pretty much on his own at this point. And if you think about it, ultimately this dream of Nehemiah's wasn't about him and it wasn't about benefiting him per se. In fact, he'd given a promise to the king of Persia that he would go back once the job was done. His dream was bigger than him. His dream was about benefiting the people of God, the Jews at the time. God's people, allowing them to regather, to have a sacred place protected by walls. And about giving glory to God. That's what he believed God was calling him to. That's what motivated him. And I guess that motivation of something that would be a legacy for generations too. So today we pick up, we're in Jerusalem, and we pick up the story, and we're going to look at this question of how does Nehemiah approach this big dream, this big, big vision? How does he tackle it? What does he do? And I guess just before I get on to what happens in today's passage, we should just touch on last week's message, or last week's passage, that first and foremostly, Nehemiah hadn't just rushed into things. He hadn't just heard a bad report and gone, right, I'm off. He actually stopped and waited on God. He prayed. He fasted. And over that period of time, I think he would have sought God's direction and really clearly felt that he divined God's purpose. And had that, I guess, had he divined that clearly enough that he then had the confidence to approach King Artaxerxes for his favour in this journey, even though he knew that Artaxerxes had previously opposed it. So that's what that period of prayer and fasting gave him, that confidence to go ahead, to know that this was the right timing from God. So within today's story, we resume, and he's now in Jerusalem, and we're going to look at which steps he takes when he gets there. So number one, here we go. I think the first thing he does is he actually takes a realistic look at the problem. Remember, he doesn't actually know the scale of the problem. He's not been there before. So what does he do? Verse 13, by night, I went out through the valley gate towards the jackal well and the dung gate, examining the walls of Jerusalem, which had been broken down, and its gates, which had been destroyed by fire. It's all rubble. Then I moved on towards the fountain gate and the king's pool, but there was not enough room for my mount to get through, I presume because of boulders and things in the way, probably. And so I went up the valley by night, examining the wall. So the valley would be that deep Kidron. It was quite deep in those days, I believe, the Kidron Valley, and you'd go along and you'd be able to look up and see the rubble of where the wall should be. The officials did not know where I'd gone or what I was doing, because as yet I had said nothing to the Jews or the priests or the nobles or the officials or any of the others who would be doing the work. So basically, at this point, Nehemiah's going on a bit of a secret reconnaissance mission. He's trying to get an understanding of just how bad the problem is. What is it really like? What is it going to take to achieve this goal? He looks at it carefully, but he's also a bit smart. He's aware that being too obvious about his intentions at this stage might stir up trouble, so he's just doing a quiet look in the night without too much of an audience. The key thing here, though, is he's understanding what he's up against, understanding the situation. Second thing, Nehemiah gives a collective invitation to contribute to other people. Although he sees this vision of rebuilding the walls as a particular sort of task God's entrusted to him to oversee, he sees the solution very collectively, and he sees it as important to extend a really collective invitation to gather everybody in and see if they want to, and get them to take part. So he already knows from the previous verse it's going to take a lot of people to do this work. And then what we see is that once he starts talking to the others about what his plan is, he's really careful to identify with them and show them that he views the destruction of Jerusalem as a collective problem they're all facing together, and they're all in it together, and they're going to find a solution together. So what he says in verse 17, he then says, I said to them, you see the trouble we are in. Jerusalem lies in ruins, and the gates have all been burned with fire. Come, let us rebuild Jerusalem, the wall of Jerusalem, and we will no longer be in disgrace. See that language? It's all about us and we. We're all in this together. We're in disgrace. This is a terrible situation. Let's get together and do it. This is his language. It's very collective. It's interesting too when you think, you know, the New Testament talks a lot about us being part of a body working together. Third thing is, God is an integral part of the whole discussion. God's hand is seen in the project, and he makes that clear to the people. He says in verse 18, I also told them about the gracious hand of my God upon me and what the king had said to me. And of course, that's really important, because what he's doing is saying, this isn't just my bright idea. I've spent time with God, and I'm pretty confident this is what he wants. And as a demonstration of that, he's actually changed the king's mind. The king is now on board. He's given us favour for this project. So he's showing how God has actually influenced someone outside as well. And they replied, let us start rebuilding. So they began this good work. So God was an integral part of the discussion. And fourthly, almost everybody does their part in beginning to rebuild the wall. And that's really important. Because when they do it, they achieve the seemingly impossible. So I'm going to read a few excerpts from chapter 3. I'm not going to read my way right all the way through it, even though Mark Wells would quite like me to. See how I go on all the names. But basically, chapter 3 is this quite detailed description of who does what and what their background was and what was significant about what they did. And all these people are tackling this project of building the wall together. So we see in verse 1 that Eliashib, the high priest, and his fellow priests went to work and rebuilt the sheep gates. You might have thought the high priest would have thought he was above the manual labour. The high priest might have been quite justified in going, oh, actually, my duties are about the temple. And you've just finished off, got the temple patched up. I'm going to stay in the temple. But no, the high priest and the priests got involved in this labour, in this project. Verse 2, the men of Jericho built the adjoining section, so they pulled in people from the neighbouring cities. Jericho is not that far from Jerusalem, it's another city. They pulled in people from the towns and villages and cities around. Verse 5, the next section was repaired by the sons of Tekoa, but their nobles would not put their shoulders to work under their supervisors. So this is showing us that life's not perfect. You know, there are always those people in any project, aren't there? Few people who just won't work under authority and won't do their share. It's real life. But other people of high rank actually did pitch in and work. So it was people from all stratas of society. So we see in verse 9 that Rephaniah, the son of Hur, ruler of a half-district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section. And verse 10, adjoining this, Jedidiah, son of Haramatha, made repairs opposite his house. And there are actually quite a few reports throughout chapter 3 of people doing the section of wall adjoining their house. And actually that makes good sense, doesn't it? Because it's a good way of motivating people and getting buy-in. If you repair that bit of the wall near your house, that'll help protect your family or your business. And good way of getting some good local buy-in. They'll do an extra good job if it's by their house, maybe. Verse 12, Shalom, son of... Well, I've gone too far, have I? Oh, no, we're right. Halahash, ruler of a half-district of Jerusalem, repaired the next section with the help of his daughters. I quite like that. It's the whole family getting involved. It's not just one family representative doing their token share. It's the whole family pitching in. And there are lots of other details and specifics about individuals who are goldsmiths or jewelers or have other special talents or trades or professions, and they're all pitching in, doing their bit on their bit of the wall. And by working together like this, the incredible thing is that the walls of Jerusalem were rebuilt in less than 2 months. After 120 years of ruin. Now that might be stealing the thunder of speaker in about 3 weeks' time, but basically it's important to see that it was this collective effort of everyone pitching in that made the difference. And in fact, part of the remnant of this wall, I think, has been uncovered in modern-day Jerusalem in the last 20 years. They think it's part of Nehemiah's wall, it's about the right age, looks like it was hastily constructed, it's in the right location. Yeah, and this was something that had been a ruin for 120 years. Something remarkable was achieved. Now, it wasn't without opposition. We're told at the end of chapter 2 that some early opposition started to emerge. And Phil's going to deal particularly with that whole topic next week, because there's a whole lot more of opposition that emerges in chapter 4. So Phil's going to talk about the whole concept of opposition and how we respond to that. So things aren't always plain sailing, but amazing things can occur. And so for today, we're focusing on the incredible impact of this vision of God given to one man, Nehemiah, and the lasting and the remarkable impact from him gathering and mobilising this quite disparate group of exiles who'd recently returned to Jerusalem and mobilising them to rebuild this wall together. And as they did that, something incredible was achieved that benefited the Jews for generations to come after that. So that's a nice story. But what does that mean for us at RCC in the 21st century, 2,500 years later? I think God has also given us a clear vision as a church. And there's some parallels. So our vision as a church at RCC is to see this city, Otatahi, Christchurch, become a place of Christ's transforming hope for the world. Now, our vision isn't so much about physical rebuilding. Although, you know, Christchurch has had a few earthquakes, and we did have a working bee last week. But the working bee last week was more about destruction, I think, than rebuilding at this stage. But, you know, that's a means to an end to our bigger vision, isn't it? Getting facilities and things we need. In fact, Christchurch, though, is broken in other ways. There are about 400,000 people here, and there are many broken people. People with broken lives, with mess. And our vision is about rebuilding the city from a spiritual perspective, to see Otatahi actually become a city that reflects its English name, Christ Church. Think about that name, Christ Church. What a name for an entire city. A place where lives can be transformed and lives can be turned around and rebuilt by hope in Jesus Christ and then influence the world. It's that ongoing outward focus. We're really clear that this is our vision as a church. It's a big vision. It might seem a bit impossible or improbable. And there'll be some resistance to that vision being fulfilled. But God is in it. And I really believe and know that when God is in the vision and when we are all willing to do our bit, then amazing things can happen. I was just reflecting back, actually. I didn't actually realise when I thought of this that we were having all the CDN youth workers up this morning. More than 20 years ago, Phil and I were members of this congregation. We had no official roles here. At that stage, Phil had just gone back to university to do his MBA studies. And someone approached Phil and said, "Huh, we've got this idea. How about we try to form a trust to fund some youth work across our city that gets external funding and sort of can work well beyond this church?" And Phil went, "Yeah, I think I could give that a go." So he did the paperwork, found out how to form a trust. It was before trusts were all over the place. And we formed this little board. It was Phil and me and Al Aitken and three other people. Didn't really know what we were doing. But it was this answer, this saying yes to a call of God, really. And you know what happened? We didn't even have our vision that clearly aligned at that time as a church, but I do believe it's part of our core vision and mandate as a church, and God just got behind it. And it was the most incredible sort of first 2 years because all this funding just came our way. And things happened you wouldn't expect, like people from the city council approaching us and offering to fund another youth worker without us asking. And it's not the kind of thing that normally ever happens. But it was that thing of, this was a God thing. It was a God project. And we were willing to do our bit, and the whole thing just sort of took off. So exciting. And a bit the same way that, you know, Nehemiah, when this was a real God moment and a God project, then the king of Persia, the biggest empire in the world at the time, actually got behind the project and gave him some extra supplies and safe passage and things to help him in his project. So what can we take from this particular story today, of the story of Nehemiah, as we move forward as a church with this big vision? First thing, prayer. Nehemiah spent months praying, didn't he? Praying, fasting, put it before God. And I think this is especially important when we're trying to move our vision forward as a church. There's a really definite role for both individual prayer and fasting, but also collective prayer. You know, church-wide prayer is so important. Our prayer in our life groups is so important. Prayer can work to unleash the power of God. It can work protectively, but also can help align us and make sure we're on track or give us that reassurance or that certainty that we're on track. The way it was for Nehemiah, it helped give him that certainty. And one story that came to mind for me was about 15 years ago. We'd recently moved back from 5 years in Australia, and Phil was just coming on to staff, or just come on staff. He wasn't quite, just about to take on the senior role, I think. And I felt God prompting me that we should have something for the women in this church. There was no women's ministry at the time. And I really felt a prompting from God that we should do something. And at the time, you know, you can feel a bit overwhelmed in some seasons of life. I had 3 kids between sort of 1 and 6. Just started on 2 jobs, so both the hospital job and the academic job. And they both felt like a step up because more senior than I've been before, more responsibility. And you sometimes think, and I thought, I don't even know people that well. I've been away for 5 years. Who's going to do it? How's it going to happen? previous thing someone had done had not worked. And you feel a bit inadequate, don't you? So I remember quite clearly, I took one Thursday, my day off work, and I thought, I'm going to pray and fast this day about this idea and see if it's really of God or not. And you know, by the end of that day, Phil came home from work, from the office, and said, do you know what? I've got this email from two young women and the young adults that you don't even know, saying they think it would be really good if there was women's ministry in church and they're willing to help. Same day. And then I really felt God prompted me to go and pray with Denise and talk to her and see if she would partner with me too. But you know, it's that confirmation of God saying, yes, I know you feel busy and I know you feel a bit out of your depth, but actually I've got your back on this. You should go forward with this because I'm in it. And that's what prayer can do for you. Secondly, we need to understand, I think, from Nehemiah, the extent of the problem. You know, and our world is a broken place, and you know, we don't want to wallow in the problems all the time, but I also think we have to, it's a balance. We don't want to just live in our little protected Christian bubbles all the time either. You know, except when the COVID level 3 or 4, then you have to stay in your bubble. But you know, the rest of the time, I think we need to do what Nehemiah did and get outside the walls and see what's going on sometimes. Because there's that verse in the song that really comes to me, it's that, it says, break my heart for what breaks yours. You know, if we are so protected we don't even know what's going on in the world, then how's our heart going to be really moved with compassion? How are we going to see where we could be a solution? And I do feel like even as parents, if we're Christian, sometimes there's a tendency to want to wrap our children in glad wrap and have them all in a cocooned in the Christian bubble all their way through their upbringing. But I actually think it's really important that we do it wisely, but that they do see the need in our world, that they are exposed to that and they are exposed to thinking about what they can do to be a solution. I think our kids have benefited from things they've been involved in. You know, a couple of them have been involved in going to some of the soup kitchens for the homeless and things. Opportunity with some of our third world mission partners to see what they're doing and what they're facing on the ground. Whatever, I think it's just really important that we understand the problem. That's what Nehemiah did. Understand the problem, then you can start looking towards the solutions. And thirdly, and really most importantly, well, they're all important, we need to build our part of the wall. Every one of us, everyone here, we have our own sphere of influence. You will know people I don't know. You will be able to speak into the lives of people I can't speak into. It might be older people, younger people, people of one ethnic group or another ethnic group. It might be people in sports clubs. It might be people in a workplace. It might be people of high influence in government, like the King of Persia. It might be any number of places where you have a sphere of influence, a sphere, or I have a sphere of influence. And I believe those are God ordained. He gives us spheres of influence so we can do our bit. And in this case, it's rebuilding Christchurch, or Te Tahi. It's bringing that transforming hope of Christ into people's lives in our city. And that is our job, every one of us. Seems a big job. But, you know, I was thinking there's about 600 people associated with this church. At the time of Nehemiah building that wall, I think Dave estimated it was about 1,500 in Jerusalem at that time. It's not such a big difference in numbers. They probably pulled in some outside help, just like we do. We work with other churches, with other people. But, you know, what we want to see is our city being rebuilt spiritually. Becoming a place of Christ's transforming hope wherever we go and wherever we have influence. And you might say, well, how do I do that? It seems a bit nebulous, a bit awkward. Well, actually, it's about how we live our day-to-day life, isn't it? It might be getting out of our comfort zone, inviting someone to Alpha next term. Adding that extra sentence or two into a conversation that lets people know God is part of your day-to-day life. God answered this prayer. this was a difficult situation. We prayed about it and look what happened. This is what God has done. This is what God is doing in my life, alive and well. Because then we open up a window for people to see God at work and can invite them in. Maybe you guys come up. You know, we can feel daunted sometimes, but if every one of us did our part, we could have an incredible citywide influence. And we need to remember that it's God who acts in us to fulfill his purposes. He gives us strength, not our strength, not just our resources. He gives us strength and resources. And I believe if we're aligned with God's will, there will undoubtedly still be challenges, but there will also be opportunities and breakthrough, and the extraordinary things will happen in our community. And the seemingly impossible becomes possible through God. So just in closing, I guess my challenge for you, am I up for that challenge? I need reminding of it. Are you up for that challenge? It's a big challenge. We might need to put aside one or two other things. You know, the people who were building the wall probably had to put aside a few other of their day-to-day activities to build the wall. It's the same for us. Sometimes we might need to put aside some things we would like to do, some other things, and prioritize doing our bit in the wall. We might need to mobilize our families or our life groups and get them on board. Challenge, put the challenge out to them. Get them into it. Because we don't really want to be remembered as like those sons of Tekoa who would not put their shoulder, who missed out on being part of something extraordinary. Come, let us rebuild Otatahi. Let us rebuild Christchurch so that it becomes a place of Christ's transforming hope for the world.
It's a big challenge, but we can do it because of the foundation we have in Jesus. And so stand, because we're going to finish with a song that reminds us of what Jesus did for us. And so we can have confidence to step out and do what we've been called to do. So.